Welcome to the Talking Biotech Podcast. It's a weekly podcast about agriculture and medicine with an emphasis on biotechnology and the good things it can do for people and a planet, and about sustainability. Our big interest is in ways that we can use modern scientific techniques to improve the food supply, especially for the food insecure. And one of the big interests in the podcast is exploring some novel fruits and vegetables to better familiarize ourselves with where they came from and where they're going in terms of their genetic improvement. Today, we're going to talk about one of my favorite fruits, mangoes. And we're talking with Dr. Emily Warshevsky. She's a postdoctoral researcher at the University of British Columbia. Hi, Emily.
Hi.
Yeah, welcome to the podcast. It's nice to have you aboard.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
I'm excited because you actually did your last degree, your PhD, here in Florida, not at University of Florida, but at Florida International University, and in conjunction with the Botanical Gardens, Fairchild Botanical Gardens. Could you talk a little bit about what you did during that time?
So I did my PhD at FIU and worked very closely with Fairchild Botanic Garden. And my project focused on the evolution and domestication of the mango and other species that are closely related to mango, the whole genus Mangifera.
And what is in Mangifera other than mangoes? I mean, anything that we recognize from food or from, you know, tropical fruit crops?
So you probably aren't familiar with many of the other species that are closely related to mango unless you have traveled in Southeast Asia. Most of these species are not cultivated outside of tropical Southeast Asia, but there in that region, some of them are actually very popular fruit crops and are, you know, kind of locally cultivated, and really some of them are quite delicious even.
Yeah, can you give us a couple examples? I mean, you know, maybe there's something that I might recognize.
Sure. One of the really popular species is Mangifera caesia. And within, it's grown mostly in Indonesia and peninsular Malaysia. And it's called Binjai there. So it's actually fascinating. It doesn't really look that much like a mango. It looks more like it's kind of pear-shaped and oftentimes brown or bright green on the outside. So it kind of looks like a pear even. And I haven't actually had the chance to taste it, which is really unfortunate, but it's supposed to have quite a nice flavor, kind of a sour, sweet flavor.
Okay. That's a good example. I mean, something I absolutely have never heard of, but I've become more and more interested in tropical fruits and fruits in general through my appointment here at the University of Florida. We worked mostly with strawberries, but in looking at our catalog of potential crops that could be used in the future here in Florida, I'm really sensitive to those opportunities. And we've got folks down in Homestead who are doing a lot of work in those areas. And so I'm always interested. But the whole podcast today really is supposed to be about mangoes. It's something that I'm really interested in just because I love the fruits so much and my bias shows. So if we're talking about mangoes, you know, as a type of fruit, why are they significant and why are they important to current, you know, are there places where they're really important to regional economies or any modern relevance to mangoes?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I think, you know, mangoes are kind of obscure to those of us who grew up in northern latitudes in North America. I grew up in rural Michigan. I didn't actually eat a mango until I was in college. But if you travel to any tropical or subtropical region of the world and you bring up mangoes with people, their faces will light up. They love mangoes. And mangoes are really important economically and as a food source in most of these countries. And I think now as our world continues to globalize and people travel and relocate to new parts of the world, mangoes are just really increasing in popularity.
Yeah, I know we do a lot of work here with post-harvest quality in mangoes because they're subject to some kinds of chilling injuries and a lot of issues with transport. And so to really get them and have one produced is really kind of a special thing. And to get them here in the state of Florida, for instance, where maybe our industry could grow or benefit from research, you know, more understanding about the domestication and varieties available, it could be something that could be of great benefit to farmers going forward.
Certainly, yeah. There's a lot of work that is focusing on kind of these immediate agricultural applications for things like post-harvest fruit quality or different treatment methods. So mangoes that are imported into the U.S. actually have to undergo some sort of treatment to help control the spread of fruit flies. And so there's a lot of research targeted at, you know, these immediate impacts for marketing and production of the mango. But my research really has focused on trying to understand the history of mango and how it got to this point in terms of the genetic diversity and evolution. And then hopefully we can use some of that knowledge to help inform our cultivation practices and better understand how to use this diversity to our advantage.
No, that's really exciting because especially because it's a tree crop, they take forever to grow new ones and forever to examine the genetics and improve the varieties. So having a firm handle on the traits that are available and where they came from and you know what people have selected over the years and what's present in the wild germplasm is really a great starting point. Well, let's go backwards. Where was mango first really domesticated or where does it occur naturally?
So that's actually kind of an interesting question. For most of our recent history, we've been assuming that mango was domesticated in India because that's where we see the most variety in cultivated mango. There are many, many cultivars of mango that are grown in India, and it's extremely popular there. India is actually the leading producer of mangoes in the whole world. But when you start to look more at both the morphological diversity and also the genetic diversity, we see that maybe there might be something more complex going on there. And that's because we have two different kinds of mangoes. We have these Indian type mangoes and Southeast Asian mangoes. And my work has confirmed kind of previous suspicions that these two different types actually represent sort of genetically distinct groups as well. And so we're not really sure why that is. There could be a number of reasons, but it could indicate that mango was perhaps domesticated multiple times or was domesticated in Southeast Asia and then relocated to India. But we do know that mango has been cultivated in India for around 4,000 years. So it's actually a pretty old domesticated tree crop when you compare it to other domesticated trees.
And are the wild mangoes, do they possess a lot of the same quality fruit traits that we really find appealing? Or are they, you know, kind of sad things? Did it take a lot of work to get it from a wild state to something that's really sweet and flavorful?
So that's a question that we don't actually have an answer to. And I think one of the most surprising things to me as a researcher is that we don't actually know where currently living wild populations of mango are. Or we think that these trees originated in the foothills of the Himalayas. So that would be northeastern India, Bangladesh, Nepal, northern Myanmar. But in terms of any information about recent surveys that have been done anything there, these individuals don't seem to be present in cultivation anywhere. So we really don't have a reference point for what wild mango looks like. We have some other species that are closely related. Based on those characteristics, we can kind of guess at what a wild mango might look like.
So there is a possibility that the actual ancestral forms of this could even be extinct, right?
Yes, definitely. For a while, the IUCN, which is this, you know, global conservation network, was listing mango as a species at risk of extinction. Now they have updated that status to say that it lacks data, which basically just means that no one has been looking for it. So I think that's a really important thing to consider. In a lot of our food crops, we don't actually know where the wild progenitor populations are or whether they still exist. And they definitely still require conservation efforts, because many of them come from places that are threatened by habitat destruction.
And that's a really good point. There's so many expeditions over the years. We talked a lot about Nikolai Vavilov on the podcast and work that he did and all of the other great explorations that went on to identify the sources of different crops. And, you know, these things exist in their ancestral form. Here in Florida, we're in the cradle of where blueberry germplasm belongs. And with every new subdivision and every new snowbird that crosses the border, these things are imperiled. And there's not money or interest in creating efforts beyond, you know, the USDA repositories and things to actually be able to identify and find new germplasm. And it's sad when something like a tree that, you know, once it goes away, you don't have it back again.
Exactly. Yeah, it's a really important part of understanding our history as people and how we have domesticated crops, but it's also important to our future and the future viability of these crops, because wild populations may have really important adaptations that could be used to expand cultivation ranges or improve disease resistance. And if we lose those adaptations will be gone forever.
Yeah, it's a really good point, and especially when there's no moving laterally from side to side, there's not that many crops that are similar. So it's not like down the road as we begin genetic engineering or gene editing, that kind of stuff, you can't just engineer in a resistance gene or something like that because you don't have a source of it. And that's one of the reasons that we get excited about conservation efforts and making sure that as we're entering really what is an explosion of potential for technology to influence these things, we have to have a template to work from, and that could be gone or threatened.
Yeah.
So what about other interesting stories about domestication? Were there anything from the literature or from antiquity that tells us about mangoes and maybe how they moved around once they were domesticated?
We believe mango was domesticated at least 4,000 years ago in India. And this is based on evidence from stone carvings at religious sites within India. So a lot of these temples and sites within the region depict mangoes on different and other fruits as well. But mangoes are clearly prevalent there. And then this domestication timeline is also based on linguistic evidence and tracing the name of the mango back in time to see where it first appears in literature. So after it was domesticated, the first evidence of it being dispersed into a new region was actually from India into Southeast Asia. And that was quite a long time ago compared to the rest of the movements. Mango was introduced from India into Southeast Asia between the 4th and 5th centuries before Common Era. So quite a long time ago. But it wasn't until about the 9th or 10th centuries that mango kind of started moving westward out of India, first into East Africa, and then in the 16th and 17th centuries into Western Africa. So this was just mango being transported by people through these common trade routes of the time. But as you know, mango is wildly popular in the Americas. It wasn't actually introduced into the Americas until the early 1700s. So it's really only been in the Americas for about 300 years, which is, you know, not that long. And funny enough, you know, you're in Florida, and that's where I did my work. Florida was actually one of the last places in the Americas to get introductions of mango. The first record, or the first recorded introduction was in 1833. So, you know, it's a really quite a recent crop in this part of the world.
Yeah, that's a but very common story, right? I mean, even our citrus trees that we think are, you know, that are iconic here in the state, and we think are the, you know, things that have always been here, really are recent introductions, and even strawberries, and strawberries too, and so it's been a mango in a way is has had a little bit of time to hang out here in the Sunshine State, and you mentioned the part about the artwork. And I've always been intrigued with artwork, not because I like art. I'd rather go study the placemat at Denny's than go to an art gallery. But when I do go to art galleries, like I've been to the Louvre, or as they say in Northern Florida, the Louver, I've been there. It's fun to see European art from the last 500 years. You don't see a wide variety of fruits and vegetables. You kind of see the same thing over and over again. And it's always grapes and things like that. You don't see a lot of, you never see any of the modern fruits. And it really is, helps you appreciate how far we've come.
Definitely. Yeah. Mango is one of many crops that have been recently introduced to this part of the world. But I think one of the really fascinating things is that despite it being a really recent introduction into Florida, Florida kind of ran with it. And South Florida, where mangoes are still cultivated today, became a really important center of breeding for mangoes. So many of the most important, globally important mango cultivars were bred in South Florida.
Oh, that's really interesting. So we'll touch on that when we come back. We're going to take a short break, and we'll talk a little bit more with Dr. Emily Warshevsky about mangoes and their domestication and their future. This is the Talking Biotech Podcast. We'll talk to you again in just a minute.
Hello, Talking Biotech listeners. This is Nick Syke from No Ideas Media. If you've never heard of No Ideas Media, we make science and agriculture communications videos to be shared on social media sites like YouTube and Facebook and Twitter. The videos are not bad, if I do say so myself, and they are pretty effective at communicating complex science and ag topics to the general public. But in order for them to reach the public, I need people like you to share the videos widely. I also need people like you to support No Ideas Media through Patreon. Patreon is a crowdfunding site, kind of like Kickstarter, but it works on smaller monthly donations. So if you'd like to help No Ideas Media continue the work that we're doing, please go to patreon.com/noideasmedia and consider being a patron. Thanks very much.
And we're back on the Talking Biotech Podcast, today talking about mangoes, one of my favorite fruits, with Dr. Emily Warshevsky, who's a postdoctoral researcher at the University of British Columbia. What are you working on now, Emily?
I've actually switched gears just a little bit. I'm still studying crop domestication and using genomic tools to understand how the process of domestication shapes our crops. But I've actually shifted to sunflowers for now.
That's cool. So I hope you join us in the future. I think that if I was a recent PhD graduate, I would be really interested in domestication stories, because what we can learn from genomics is so cool. And we have this great tools that allow us to answer all these old questions. And I'd work on genomics of plants, but I'd also look at animals, because just the domestication stories around animals are so many and really interesting. And to put a molecular proofing on it, to actually test the tails, would be really exciting. So, you know, good luck to you on that stuff.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Yeah. And that was one of the things that was exciting about working with mango, was we had this idea that mango was from India, and also, you know, that it was introduced into these new parts of the world. and we kind of wanted to understand how that shaped mango diversity and kind of verify, is that true? Do we actually see that pattern reflected in the genetics?
And so in your work for your doctorate degree, you dissected those patterns and that lineage and tried to understand this. Could you give us a little bit of idea of how a modern detective, what tools would you use to start to look at those relationships and examine them carefully?
Sure. Yeah. Well, I start with leaf samples. So most people, I think, when I talk about mangoes, assume that I am getting DNA out of the fruit, but it's actually much easier to get DNA out of leaf samples. So I collected leaf samples from different mangiferous species to ask questions about the evolutionary history, but then also many, many different mango cultivars, individuals of mangoes. And I, you know, took the DNA samples, and I was able to use fairly recent developments in genetics, which basically take a small pieces of the genome from all across the genome, and you can amplify those across individuals and compare. So this gave me thousands of little bits of information from across the genome of each individual that we could use to compare these individuals and see how are they related to one another. Do certain populations of mangoes, so I was looking at mangoes from different regions of the world, do certain regions of the world have higher mango diversity than others? So those are kind of the questions that we can answer. And then based on those answers of, you know, where is the mango diversity highest or lowest, or how are these populations related to one another, we can start to understand how the domestication and how humans' dispersal of the mango has happened over time.
And so you're not doing like whole genome sequencing. You're looking for maybe one region, which could be a hypervariable, or maybe a number of regions or specific genes. And that's the basis for your analysis?
Right. So in order to do whole genome sequencing, we actually are just getting the first whole genome sequences of mango that are being finished up by some folks at the USDA and a couple other international groups. And so I was still using tools that are kind of available to crops and other animals and plants that you don't need to know what the sequence that you're looking at is. It's basically kind of just almost randomly selecting parts of the genome. And so some of those will be really variable and some will be less variable, but it's actually really useful because you can then use these to answer questions at different evolutionary timescales. So you can look at population diversity, and you can also look at diversity between species.
And you also could use the certain markers to look for associations with traits that are of interest to breeders. And what are some of the main traits that people are breeding for when looking at improving modern mango?
Yeah, so that's definitely something that we're still kind of working towards in mango and starting to get a foothold with associating particular genes with traits. It's a difficult process, but some of the traits I think that breeders are really interested in, the main ones, I think we've done a pretty good job at picking fruits that are tasty, and the problem being, as we talked about earlier, getting those fruits to market. So there's traits associated with marketability and transport that are really important to breeders, because they can grow the best mango in the world, but if they can't get it to market, what good is it to them? But there's also traits associated with disease resistance. And there's also certain things with environmental tolerances. So in particular, salinity tolerance can be really important. And there's also a really interesting thing in mango these trees, if you just let them grow, will get to be very large. And so we don't actually have a dwarfing rootstock or anything like that available yet. So I think that's another thing that breeders are really looking for. And that kind of brings in this other side. We're breeding not only for fruit characteristics, but also for traits that are found in the root systems in these rootstocks.
Well, that would be extremely valuable. I would love to see a dwarfing rootstock, which probably could get pretty easily just through mutagenesis. But my main trait that I'm interested in is cold tolerance, because I would love to have a mango tree in my yard, but I get two or three freezes a year, and I don't think that it would stand a chance. Is there any evidence of cold tolerance in any of the wild germplasm?
Yeah, well, that's the really interesting thing about this hypothetical ancestral range of wild mango. It's supposed to be from what they call the foothills of the Himalayas. So that's actually more of a subtropical range to begin with. Northern India and Nepal and Bhutan, you know, those are not hypertropical. And so you would think that there has to be some sort of cold tolerance available in some of that wild germplasm, if it still exists, or perhaps in some of these other closely related species that also grow there.
Yeah, just my luck. The trait that I need is extinct.
Yeah. Well, there are definitely at least one or two other species that are probably very closely related to mango that still grow there. We know that for sure. So maybe some of those could be used as rootstocks or, hybridized with mango to help promote cold tolerance. I think that would be really great, because I know a lot of people would love to grow mango.
Well, how long does it take to grow a tree? Like, if you were to plant that big crazy seed, which is really interesting, plant that big seed, and after it germinates, how long till it actually is a bearing fruit tree?
That can vary. My understanding, I don't actually grow mango trees myself, but my understanding is that, short timeline would be probably about 5 years from seed. Yeah. So that's quite a while to wait. and that's one of the things that makes it difficult to breed mangoes, is this long time period. It can take longer than that, I'm sure, as well, 7 years or perhaps even more, depending on conditions.
Yeah, all right. I'll cross that off my bucket list then, because I'd get a generation or two.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's really good. So going forward, what's happening in the future of this? Are there national organizations or international organizations that promote the growing and improvement of mangoes? Or is this kind of just a small number of maybe USDA and a few other private breeders around the world?
Yeah. So actually, in the U.S., based in Orlando, we have the National Mango Board. So this is a collective of people who are more on the agricultural side of things. So this is mostly like producers of mango. But this is a board within the U.S. that promotes mango cultivation and is trying to make sure to get mangoes to market in new places within the U.S. and just help educate people about how to cut a mango, which, sometimes is quite difficult for people to understand if they've never done it before. It has that big seed on the inside. So they're a really fantastic organization, I think, that's doing some really great work. And then on the more research side of things, there is the USDA, and they have some great projects going on with mango research. And there are other organizations similar to the USDA or versions of the USDA in other countries, right? So Australia has their own version of the USDA. Their agricultural research programs that are working on mangoes. And there's also a great group in Israel that's doing a lot of work with mangoes. So it's something that people across the world are interested in, definitely.
Well, that's really good news. I know the cutting the mango question is always a good one. And the way I do it, I cut the long way along the seed and then make like a grid with a fillet knife on.
That's like a checkerboard.
Yeah, make a checkerboard and then take the fillet knife and use it like you're skinning a fish and just cut the skin off the mango. And then you get that, these little cubes. And, you know, the other interesting thing about this, what do you know about that compound that's present in mangoes that causes rashes and, response like poison ivy?
Yeah. So that's another really common question I get when I talk to people about mangoes. They either say, I love mangoes. They're my favorite fruit. Or they say, I'm allergic to mangoes. and that's because, as you hinted at there, mangoes are in the poison ivy family. So they are actually one of a few important crops. Cashews and pistachios are also in the same family, which is really interesting. But they do have similar compounds to what we find in poison ivy in the skin of the mangoes, in the sap of the mangoes. So I actually do react to them myself. So I have to be very careful when I'm out collecting. I'll get a rash from the sap that comes out of the leaf stems when I pick them.
In all of your travels and in all of your exposure to different types of mangoes, is there one that stands out in your mind as one that was exceptional in its flavor?
The more I travel, the more I realize how personal a question that is. So every different region has their own mango that they think is the best mango. For me personally, I do really enjoy some of these Southeast Asian mango cultivars, like Chokanan is quite good, and Nam Dak Mai as well. So they're great. But, you know, the flavor profiles in Indian mangoes are also really excellent.
And one of the big interests of the podcast is how we can use modern technology and just genetic improvement in general in the interest of sustainability. And if you think about everything you know about mangoes and its diversity and where it is and where it's going, are there any particular ways that mangoes can help the, say, economic sustainability of developing world farmers, or the environmental sustainability, or maybe have some social sustainability edges? Anything that comes to mind?
I think, well, I'm not sure if this exactly answers your question, but I think that mangoes are actually a very important food source in a lot of developing countries. A lot of countries that may have food instability, and something that sticks out to me is a few years ago, I was reading an NPR story, and there was a quote from a woman in there who was in a developing country, and she was talking about some times of the year, all they had to eat for the whole day was mangoes from their mango tree. And so we shouldn't, you know, mangoes in the U.S. are kind of a novelty, and kind of, you know, they can be kind of pricey sometimes. But we shouldn't forget that in many parts of the world, this is actually a really important food source, an important source of nutrients to people. And so there are things that we should be doing to try to help improve productivity and cultivation in those countries.
That's a really great point. And maybe even some genetic improvement in the West may have very important benefits for folks around the world. And that's really exciting.
Definitely.
So if people wanted to learn more about you and your program, maybe follow you on social media, where would they do that?
Sure. They can find me on Twitter right now. And that's just at Eworszewski. You should be able to find the spelling of my last name on this. And I'm also working on a website right now that should be up and running in the next few months, hopefully. So I'll probably have some of this information and some of my articles, both kind of popular press articles that I've written, as well as the more scientific journal articles, available on there.
That sounds great. Well, Dr. Emily Warshevsky, thank you so much for joining me. I learned a lot from the episode, and I look forward to going home and eating a mango I was saving for today. So thank you very much.
Excellent. Well, enjoy that mango.
And thank you for listening to the Talking Biotech podcast. Share it with a friend, talk to people about fruits and their domestication, and help share the beautiful ideas that scientists can give us and how we're able to improve fruits for people and a planet. I'm Kevin Folta, and thank you again. We'll talk to you next week.
Thank you for listening to the Talking Biotech podcast. Send your suggestions for guests, comments, or questions to talkingbiotech@gmail.com. Please write a review of this podcast on iTunes and recommend it to a friend. More downloads help us reach a wider audience with science.